Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, December 1st, 2016. Warnings of a repeat of Rwanda's genocide in South Sudan prompt the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. to call for an arms embargo on the country.
We are urging Security Council members to act quickly to impose an arms embargo in order to change at least one dimension of the South Sudanese government's actions.
And reports of a rise in human rights abuses persist across South Sudan.
There are unprecedented levels of violence and ethnic tension all over South Sudan. Any sense of national identity is crumbling, and tribal or ethnic identity is taking over.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The head of the UN Commission of Human Rights in South Sudan says ethnic cleansing is taking place in some areas of the country. Yasmin Suka warns in a statement that conditions are ripe for a repeat of the Rwandan genocide. The commission wrapped up a 10-day visit to South Sudan yesterday. Suka says, quote, "There is already a steady process of ethnic cleansing underway in several areas of South Sudan, using starvation, gang rape, and the burning of villages," end quote. Also this week, the United States said it has credible information that South Sudan's government is targeting civilians in central Equatoria State and preparing for large-scale attacks within days and weeks. U.S. Ambassador to the Human Rights Council Keith Harper told a special session of the UN body in Geneva yesterday that the South Sudanese government has mobilized at least 4,000 militia members and is staging the fighters in Equatoria to begin conducting attacks. South Sudan Deputy Minister of Information Akol Paul Cordit flatly denied the claims.
I think this is unfounded because, first of all, there is no way Juba can prepare for offensive to fight who? The SPLM-AIO is part of the Constitutional Government of National Unity, and we are working together now with the SPLM-AIO to implement the peace agreement. And therefore, there's no way we can prepare for offensives against our own partner in the Transitional Government of National Unity.
Harper says the United States is alarmed about reports of deteriorating conditions in South Sudan, noting 1,900 homes in central Equatoria had been destroyed over the last 2 months. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power reiterated that the U.S. is pushing the U.N. Security Council for an arms embargo in South Sudan.
We see thousands of troops being deployed to the Equatorias, which for a long time were peaceful, even through the life of this conflict, and now where violence is picking up. We are seeing significant displacement still. Well over a million people have flowed into Uganda, including hundreds of thousands just since July, since the latest spike in violence. And we are urging Security Council members to act quickly to impose an arms embargo in order to change at least one dimension of the South Sudanese government's actions, which is their propensity for choosing armed systems over food for their people.
A resolution must have 9 votes in favor and no vetoes to be adopted. Russia and China have resisted imposing an arms embargo on South Sudan because they are not convinced it would achieve anything. But there are reports that diplomats do not expect Russia and China to block the measure if it comes up for a council vote. Yasmin Suka, his group of UN investigators heard firsthand accounts of criminal acts, including rape, that women have experienced since the surge in fighting occurred in July. Waki Simon Mudu has this report from Juba.
Yasmin Suka, head of the UN Human Rights Delegation, expressed concern over South Sudan's future due to the growing number of human rights abuses across South Sudan.
There are unprecedented levels of violence and ethnic tension all over South Sudan. Any sense of national identity is crumbling, and tribal or ethnic identity is taking over.
More than 200,000 internally displaced persons, or IDPs, are sheltering at several UN camps across the country. Soka says her team visited some of the conflict hotspots, including Malakal, Bentiu, and Wau, in order to speak with some of the IDPs. She says women continue to suffer at the hands of armed men in uniform.
Women in the camps recounted gruesome acts of sexual and gender-based violence to us, describe how they were forcefully taken from their homes, dragged into bushes, tied to trees, and raped in abandoned buildings. On the day we visited Bentiu, we heard reports that three women had been raped outside the site that same day. We also met a woman from Lier raped by soldiers on the road to Bentiu some days before.
Soka also describes a story of a woman at a UN-run camp in Juba who recounted how her daughter was gang-raped by men in uniform in July. The girl came out of the UN-run Protection of Civilian, or POC, site to search for food when she was reportedly gang-raped. Soka says months after she was raped, the girl is unable to sit on her own for long because of the injuries she sustained. And Soka accuses all the warring parties in South Sudan of forcefully recruiting children into their ranks.
The fact that forced and child recruitment is being conducted by all parties to the conflict and has even involved NGO staff being swept up and taken to military barracks and then later released after showing their identity cards. This renewed recruitment is an indicator that all parties are preparing for the next conflict.
Soka also expressed the concern about the way the ongoing conflict is denying South Sudan's children their right to education. She says her team learned that there are no secondary schools in all the UN-run camps hosting the IDPs. She says an estimated 9,300 teachers have already fled the country due to the ongoing violence and the difficulty economic conditions, making it impossible for some parents to feed their families. This is the second time a UN human rights team has visited South Sudan since violence flared up again in July. The team first visited South Sudan in September and met with the senior government officials, including the first vice president, Taban Dengai, and 8 agency officials. Jamet David is the executive director of the Juba-based Foundation for Democracy and Accountable Governance. He is urging international and South Sudanese officials to sit up, take a notice, and do something about the escalation in human rights abuses.
Let this just not be a report kept around somewhere in a library for people to be reading about what is going on in South Sudan. And neither should it also be a report that is helping countries to decide whether to send their citizens to South Sudan or not because of the human rights situation. We believe that any kind of investigation or any kind of evaluation of this situation should be able to have tangible outcome.
Soka says the widespread abuses have forced at least 3 million people to flee their homes, with many taking refuge in the neighboring countries. Soka says she is disappointed by the slow progress in implementing of Chapter 5 of the peace agreement, which calls for establishment of a hybrid court to try those accused of committing abuses across the country.
There are several steps that could and should be taken now to avert catastrophe. These are sanctions, asset freezes, an arms embargo, and the immediate deployment of the 4,000-strong protection force in South Sudan, which should not be restricted to the capital alone.
She also says the South Sudan government and the international community, including the African Union and IGAD, need to end the war talk and hate speech, which could fuel further violence across the country. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Today is World AIDS Day. Some people living with HIV/AIDS in South Sudan say they continue to be discriminated against and are stigmatized in society. Health officials say 13,000 new infections have been reported this year in South Sudan, bringing the total number of people living with HIV/AIDS to more than 200,000. Tito Justin has the story for VOA from Juba.
Yeah. A group of HIV-positive women sing a song in the local Acholi language, saying they need support from international organizations and the government to stop the spread of the virus. Evelyn Letio has lived with HIV for more than 24 years. She says every South Sudanese, especially those living with HIV or AIDS, have a right to good health care.
We can't keep quiet anymore. Stigma and discrimination is the first challenge that we are facing, because when we are stigmatized, many people remain. They don't come to health settings. They don't access treatment. In that way, they die of AIDS.
Letio says people living with HIV are often discriminated against in offices. She says some are denied job opportunities, something she calls unacceptable. Letio says when a person living with HIV receives proper care, they are likely to live longer. Grace Powell is a first lieutenant in the Sudan People's Liberation Army who has lived with HIV for the past 10 years. Powell, who appears healthy, says she contracted the virus when she had two children. She says after taking antiretroviral drugs, she gave birth to three more children who were not infected with the disease. Speaking in Arabic, Powell urges everyone to get tested for HIV so that they receive treatment and prolong their lives if they are HIV positive.
Some people are saying that we have enemy such as Riek Machar, but the enemy I know is HIV. We can't see it or know it except after testing. It doesn't know children, adult, or even pastor, or even lawyers. Let everyone go for testing so that they will know their status.
Paul says HIV-positive people can live long, productive lives if treated early. She says people die because of the stigma attached to virus and are afraid to get tested, including orphans.
For us people with HIV or people who do not know the virus have the stigma, let them help those people, because some people are helpless. You find their parents are dead, they are children, no one helps them or sponsor them in school. For us in South Sudan, if you have HIV, they say you are useless. You are already a dead person, but the children need help.
According to the HIV and AIDS Commission, 193,000 people were living with HIV in South Sudan in 2015, and of that number, 18,000 are youths between the ages of 18 and 24. Habib Dafala, Director General for Program Coordination at the South Sudan AIDS Commission, says the number increased by 13,000 this year, which means more than 200,000 people are living with the virus in South Sudan. He says the number is especially high among youths in Equatorial Region, where many do not have access to humanitarian aid workers.
We still need to do a lot more on HIV/AIDS awareness, for people to know what HIV is, for people to know how to live positively, for people to know that it is wrong to stigmatize against people who are living positive. Everyone has the right to health services.
Dafala says it's the duty of every citizen to fight against the spread of HIV/AIDS and to fight the stigma attached to those living with the disease. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. How does hate speech spread in South Sudan? Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you want to do before you die?
I'd love to make a commemorable event for the whole country, for my country to know, as in to help like a very specific group of people who can remember at any time that I helped them once in a while.
I want to have visited every country in Africa: Nigeria, Liberia, Togo, Cote d'Ivoire, Guinea, all of them. I really want to be there.
Okay, I would want to be successful so that I pay back my parents for what they have invested in me, and of course live a good life.
Now, before I die, I want to be a women activist and the voice for the vulnerable, whether through an already established organization or a CBO, or starting up my own organization.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. We begin a special series today on hate speech among South Sudanese. Top UN officials and aid workers warn there is a lot of hate speech among various South Sudanese communities. John Tanza, host of South Sudan in Focus, recently spoke with South Sudanese activist Nyamun Mashar in Portland, Maine, and activist and blogger Queer Garang, who lives in Canada.
I'm sure some of you have had experience with hate speech, and you must have come across it on Facebook or Twitter or whatever social platform that is out there. Could you tell us a little bit of your experience with hate speech on a personal level? Have you ever experienced hate speech? Gwir?
I have experienced a lot of hate speech, especially on social media, and I also do a lot of writings on South Sudanese political issues. So I've experienced that, and it's mostly to do with me writing against, a given political figure in South Sudan. So they don't see it as me criticizing that political figure. They just see me as criticizing the whole tribe where that political figure comes from.
Nyamun, share with us your experience. Has anybody ever attacked you for expressing your views?
Yes, they have. It was actually after a video that was posted that went viral of a protest that I did, and I shared one of my poems that talked about child soldiers and related it to the violence going on in South Sudan. I did not call anyone out. I was talking more about the leadership and how the humanitarian violations and how the people are affected by it. I think that because my last name holds such a political stigma that it seems that I was spreading propaganda, but it was definitely more of a humanitarian message. But it's really hard for people to receive messages from an opposite tribe that they might think is the enemy or the oppressive force, that any sort of message that comes from me is going to seem like I am aiding my uncle or I'm trying to push his political agenda.
What kind of things do you write in your articles or pieces? What kind of things do you say?
Accountability for leaders, you know, to be accountable to them. So I try to hold them accountable. I try to actually say, what exactly are you offering the people? You want to be a leader, but what are you offering? What is your platform? What are you saying? But I also try to tell the youth that if the elders or if the political elders are not doing what we want them to do in the country, why can we change the direction? That doesn't always stick in. It always comes back to me as me being hateful.
You say any message from the opposite side is regarded as an attack on the other side. Mm-hmm. Now, looking at our cultural upbringing, where we were born and brought up, has there been any hate among communities traditionally?
I think we have to have an honest conversation and say that there are tribal cliques that happen, but that's just human nature. And in the history of South Sudan and the different cultural representations that each tribe has makes it created a little bit of a friendly competition at first, but when war and violence get added to it, like there's always the stigma of this is something that I've witnessed here in Maine, of the Dinka and the Nuer tribe kind of shunning the other tribes for not staying to fight when the past civil war happened at the north. And I feel like that's a stigma that kind of trickles on, where it was, at first, it might have been a little humorous, it was just kind of poking fun, but now it holds a very real emotion because the Dinka and the Nuer tribes are some of the biggest represented tribes in the political seats right now.
And Queer Garang, what is the experience in Canada like? I mean, communities in Canada coexisting peacefully in the backdrop of this crisis in the country?
It's actually very interesting, because what we usually don't talk about is that these differences, you know, existed prior to the 2013 incident. In Calgary, for example, different tribes, you know, do their own things. For example, if there are weddings or there are any events, you know, they do their own events, you know, without other tribes. If there are people from other tribes who go to these events, these are mostly maybe a few friends. But then there's no any general program by the leaders, by the elders, to sort of say, okay, we as South Sudanese, where do we come together? We only come together if, for example, there's a political figure. For example, when Wani came here, all the tribes came together. But they only came to come and hear what he's to say. But anything to do with intertribal understanding within Calgary is not there.
And in your own words, why are people not willing to come together?
The problem is because What do we do now? What do we do, because we are a collection of different nationalities, tribal nationalities, to come up with a program that can actually make us look at ourselves as the national entity? And then with the government of South Sudan now, after independence, they never said, look, what do we do? We were just a force opposed to Khartoum, and that was our identity. But when we came to be an independent state, what do we do in terms of tribes so that we can see a unity in diversity? There's no any national program, any policy-based program that can actually make people come together. So people here look up to South Sudan to see how they can relate. And when they look back to South Sudan, there's nothing that unites people, and that is the main problem we have.
That's activist Namun Mashar in Portland, Maine, and Queer Garung, an activist and blogger in Canada who writes extensively on South Sudanese politics. Tomorrow, Namun and Queer share their experiences of hate speech after violence broke out in Juba in late 2013. A South Sudanese civil society activist says the country's economy will completely collapse if fighting continues in the country. The executive director of the South Sudan Network for Democracy and Elections says the government must silence the guns in order to rescue the country's economy. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
Rajab Mohandis describes South Sudan's plummeting currency to make his point.
When you exchange $1 for 100 SS South Sudanese pounds, it is not a joke. And when you have now joined Somalia and Syria as the largest contributors of refugees in the world, this is not a simple situation. When our roads have become insecure for us to move on, to move as people and also to move goods and services, this is not a simple situation.
Mohandis says unless South Sudanese can identify the root causes of the country's troubles, there will never be a solution for the economic crisis. In Juba, Mohandis says many young people are forced to go on the street to look for ways of survival.
You get with the young people, they struggle running around to see if they can wash your vehicles. In fact, people force you to accept that they wash your vehicles. There are people, when you move, when you drive around, you come to, for example, the traffic lights, you stop. Young people just come to you and begin struggling to ask you for money, you know, begging for money and all this. And, of course, many people cannot afford sometimes, and they go, they sleep on empty stomach just because of this economic situation.
While commodity prices continue to soar each day, the local currency continues to lose value against the dollar. Today in the black market, one U.S. dollar exchanges for 85 South Sudanese pounds. Mohandi says a kilogram of sugar sold at 10 South Sudanese pounds a year ago, but today it costs 120 South Sudanese pounds. A half-liter bottle of drinking water sold for 1 South Sudanese pounds a year ago, today it costs 15 South Sudanese pounds. Mohandi says there must be an inclusive political process and full implementation of the peace deal to restore the economy.
We need to work out a mechanism to get out of the crisis, the political crisis, the security situation, so that we're able to save money and put this money in the pockets of public servants so that they're able to afford food for themselves, for their children, and also pay for basic needs like education, water, and medication.
Mohandis is urging lawmakers to stop dragging their feet and implement a peace deal. He says South Sudanese can never achieve any progress if different factions continue wasting the country's resources by fighting each other.
Our parliament also has a responsibility to push strongly to see that provisions of the agreement are implemented. They will help us to change the situation. The peace agreement is not peace itself, it's a framework.
He says the government should work to harmonize different views on how the country's economy can be rebuilt. In mid-October, the South Sudan's finance minister, Stephen Thiou, told the parliamentarian in Juba while presenting the national budget for the year 2016 to 2017 that the country's economy reforms cannot be achieved in the absence of peace in the country.
The achievement of peace coupled with economic reform is the only way to return the country towards a sustainable first suite of economic development. I hope the reform within this budget combined with peace and expansion of international support will lay the foundations for recovery.
The economic reforms include doubling taxes on luxurious items, boosting agriculture, tourism, among others. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
The United Nations has delivered the first batch of life-saving medicine and hospital equipment for health centers across Sudan. The European-made drugs were purchased by the UN using money from the Sudan government to avoid the U.S.-backed international sanctions imposed on Sudan. As Nabil Biaja reports from Khartoum, the drugs arrived on the heels of price hikes that threatened to cause widespread political unrest across the country.
The urgently needed medicine was delivered a few days ago as part of an agreement signed in March by the United Nations Development Programme, or UNDP, and Sudan's Ministry of International Cooperation. Marta Reuters, the UNDP representative in Sudan, says the UN signed the deal with the government so that innocent Sudanese civilians would not be hurt by sanctions imposed on the government of President Omar al-Bashir.
The project aims to overcome challenges of access to convertible currency and restrictions on international banking transactions that can provide medicines to vulnerable populations across Sudan.
The economic embargo on Mr. Bashir's government was first imposed in 1997 for accusations of harboring terrorist organizations in the country. Later, the sanctions were tightened for war crimes and crimes against humanity that President Bashir is accused of orchestrating in Sudan's Darfur region. Reuters says the new project is worth $60 million and will expand over the next 3 years.
And we hope that this innovative approach to delivering medicines, to medical and laboratory equipment and consumables to Sudan will be a first step towards alleviating the suffering of many patients. So we are looking forward to developing and to building more partnerships with the government of Sudan, with the Federal Ministry of Health, with the NMSF, for the benefit and the health of the people of Sudan over the coming years.
Bahar Idris Abu Garda is Sudan's Minister of Health. He says the cost of medicine has shot up in recent weeks, causing outrage. But speaking in Arabic, he says, this new joint project with UNDP is good news for the Sudanese people.
These days there is a lot of noise about medicines, but through this cooperation with the UN to make available medicines that cannot otherwise be secured, I think it is very important and timely.
Khartoum resident Mohammed Mustafa says the delivery of medical supplies is good news, but it will not solve what he calls the healthcare crisis in Sudan.
Our problem here with the health and healthcare, you know, in Sudan is not sanctions. Sanctions hurt Sudanese people, yes, but the big problem is the government. They don't put essential services like healthcare, like education as a priority. So it is a problem of policies.
Mustafa says healthcare remains very expensive in Sudan and ordinary citizens are not able to pay for services at private hospitals and clinics across the country. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biaggio in Khartoum.
And that's our show for this Thursday. We leave you with the song Poison by Daddy Lumba. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. We hope to see you back here tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.